You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into the top.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
We can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches for the night.
The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern
Minnesota. 14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening to everyone joining us here on the Weather Junkies. It's June 9th, so already our second show here in June. Hard to believe how fast time is flying by. Here in Connecticut, of course, I'm joining the show from Connecticut as always. It doesn't quite feel like summer completely. The humidity has just gone away, and really there's no sign of it to come here in the near future. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joined alongside by Dakota Smith, who is joining us this evening from Colorado.
Hey, everyone. As always, I'm in Fort Collins, Colorado, and it is a hot one out here. I believe we reached 93 in Fort Collins. We're sitting under that ridge, and we're expected upper 80s, lower 90s for the next few days. So I finally begrudgingly turned on my AC during the day because it just is too hot. I've actually been not using it when it was in the 80s or so, because at night it gets really, really cool, but had to turn on the AC. So it's humid out there, Tyler?
No, it's not humid. I am loving this weather. We really haven't had any oppressive humidity.
It's about time.
A little bit humid over Memorial Day weekend, but now there's just nothing. The air is bone dry, and it looks like it's going to be that way for days to come.
And so, let's see. Our guest tonight is in the similar area that you are. And, yeah, it's a special guest, as always, Ryan Breton, a good friend of ours. He graduated from Penn State just this spring with a degree in meteorology. He's been running Atkinson Weather since 2006, and he has over 35,000 likes on that page on Facebook. And right now he's working as a broadcast meteorologist at NH1 News Network. Ryan, how's the weather where you are?
Well, first, thanks so much for having me. It's like being with two old friends here tonight, so really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Tyler, one interesting thing about the weather today was it was so windy, and I actually don't remember a June day with sunshine and such consistently strong winds. We had wind gusts consistently in the 30 miles per hour range today in southern New Hampshire where I am.
It definitely felt more like a March day with the wind, the days when you have such dry air and the wind, or either a fall day because it was so, at least started a little murky, I was a little concerned, but now the sky is completely clear. But yeah, a lot of wind. But I would take that any day over 90 with humidity. We haven't really had much severe weather. I don't think we've had any severe weather yet this season. We did back in February, but I think we're on borrowed time.
I certainly agree. Second half of June into July is the time to really get severe weather around here. So if we don't get into a pattern soon with that, we may go unscathed, which is good.
Last summer,
for the general public,
much at all going on. So.
Right.
I don't know.
So let's go into the tweets of the week here. We'll start out with one from Ian Livingston. We've had a few of his tweets on the show thus far, and I don't really want to talk about this that much because we spent a whole episode on it. But I thought I'd share it so our viewers can read it if they haven't yet. His tweet says, "Attacking storm chasers doesn't accomplish anything, and it's often misinformed." It's a great piece in Capital Weather Gang in the Washington Post. So check it out if you haven't. You can follow him at IS Livingston.
Yeah, it looks like it got a lot of reaction here in the reply section to the tweet. It looks like even some people that have come on the show have chimed in. But I you know, just based on the short tweet that he published, I think our opinions when we had the show were spot on. You know, we didn't really attack storm chasers. My opinion is that it's a free country. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I think he was mainly a rebuttal to the Slate article. So I think it did well. I think it was kind of the middle ground, honestly. Some people saw it as pro-chasing or whatever, but I kind of thought it was a pro-chasing but pretty middle ground, because he addressed some of the issues that we talked about last
week.
Any
thoughts on that, Ryan?
We might have lost Ryan for a minute there, but we'll move on to the next tweet here from Dan Satterfield. You can follow him at Wild Weather Dan. He's a broadcast Met and degree in meteorology, got a master's degree in earth sciences. And his tweet says, "Forecasts are getting better, but the public is being given lousy forecasts. The consequences could be deadly." And he shared a blog post that he wrote for AGU. I kind of have been toying with this idea on the Weather or Not podcast, and because the last one I did, I talked to four or five people, and three of them got their weather information solely from the Weather Channel app, and all of them were caught off guard by the hail and wind that, you know, they weren't expecting. They were expecting thunderstorms, but they had no idea it was going to be that bad. Actually, Ryan, you suggested this tweet this week, so what's your take on this?
Right. I think that we're kind of getting into the debate of what is an accurate forecast and what is a good forecast. And is an accurate forecast, even if we hit the number, right on target, is that still a good forecast? And I think the argument that the folks at AccuWeather maybe are making in response to Dan's post is that there are humans involved in the process, and the forecast that's seen on the AccuWeather app does have some modification by a meteorologist. I think that my concern is if a user is only getting their weather information from a weather app and only sees an icon number and probability of precipitation, they're not getting the whole picture. So the public is less informed. And I think that's what Dan maybe is trying to get at by focusing on the idea that these are less accurate. But I think that our discussion in this topic as a field should be, are people getting everything they need out of an app? And I think the answer is no.
I absolutely agree. I don't think they are getting what they need. This is such a big issue. Anytime I hear someone conversing with others and they say, oh, yeah, well, it's going to rain, or, you know, it's going to be dry, and then another person says, oh, where'd you hear that? And they say, my app. And as the meteorologist, you're kind of cringing, saying, it's either not that simple, or probably that's not true either. But I don't know how long that can go on before. I mean, we're smart, right? Aren't we smart enough to realize if things are wrong time and time again that we should look for somewhere else?
Right.
So in this post here by Dan was, you know, there was a picture of an AccuWeather forecast. We should at least note that they go out to, what, 90 days now instead of 45?
It was extended recently.
Well, and I didn't even look that far into it, because it was really that 45-day forecast that was the news getter. And now 90, you know, you can go out as far as you want. It's the same deal.
Right.
But I think the big issue with the later forecast that they put out, and other people have said this, is how they present it, the one number in the one icon. Even if there's meteorological input, I mean, 3 months away, one number and one icon is not going to cut it.
And this brings us back to, I know that you probably don't want to dwell on this topic for too long, but this is something that in the Weather Enterprise has been discussed for years. The National Academy published the Fair Weather Report way back in the 2000s that said we need to emphasize uncertainty. And we're actually going further away from that if we're giving straight deterministic forecasts beyond 7 or 10 days, you know.
One of Dan's lines that
stands out the most, perhaps because it's bold, says, he wrote, "The popularity of these smartphone apps using mostly automated forecasts has led to a situation where most Americans are getting forecasts that are worse than they received 15 years ago." And I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Right. And, I mean, and this is, it's unfortunate the article was geared toward AccuWeather, because you can put all of those apps kind of in the same, you know, area, I would say. If people don't understand what they're seeing, it doesn't matter if it's 100% accurate, too. And that's my point. Even if AccuWeather says their app is the most accurate, I actually don't really care. Meteorologically, and maybe based on the numbers, that's great. But if people aren't understanding what they're seeing, that's the problem that I would have with that. And if they're not getting the whole picture from the app.
Yeah, I believe it's James Spann that has said before, you know, your forecast can be really good and spot on, but if people don't act on it in the way that you thought they would or should, then your forecast is worthless. I'm not sure if that was him, but I believe it was.
He's one of the greats, so I'm sure it was.
I want to chime in here. Right after I read this, I sent out a little tweet and said, could someone make the case for 45-day forecast? And I got a lot of responses, and they were all pretty good. And generally, the consensus was, from a business standpoint, it makes sense. From a science standpoint, not really. Matt Mahalik said, it's smart from a business standpoint. Science-wise, you got to start somewhere, maybe. And Devin Boyer had a nice response. There's lots of value in sub-seasonal forecasting, very important in energy markets, which is, yeah, that's a great point. But, you know, with the getting down to the detail that these 45 to 90-day forecasts go, it doesn't really make any sense, and he made that point as well. So that's
it's
kind of
like, 2 cents. You know, it's just like a news story. You have a car accident, you have a picture with, you know, guts and gore in it, and most people in person will say, oh, don't post that. But you post it, everyone clicks, everyone looks, they all want to see it. So it's the same idea.
Yeah, but no, it's not. It's not the same idea. It's a science. Meteorology is a science, and there should be some respect for the science of forecasting, I think.
What I'm saying is, even if someone tells you they understand the forecast is not right, they will absolutely click on it. That's what I'm saying. They'll absolutely go where it is to look and see what it is. Even if they know a little bit that it's probably not worth looking at, they'll still look. That's my point.
Yeah, if I can just add one point, I think that something we're seeing in the field is that 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, the forecaster was able to control the message. If the National Weather Service wanted to issue a winter storm watch 48 hours before the first snowflake fell, and a winter storm warning 24 hours before the first snowflake fell, they could do that with little to no issue. Conversely, in a case of severe weather, now we have these outlooks that go out many days that people post. 5 or 10 years ago, we didn't have that. And the forecaster could control the message. And now with these apps that are out there and forecasters doing it at home, as you know, I'm guilty. As a kid, I did it, and we'll talk about that, I think, but I did it in a responsible way. There are people that may not be doing it in a responsible way, but I think that the field is still struggling, especially these forecasters who have been around for a long time, that we can't control the message anymore. And because AccuWeather took a step in that direction of putting even more information out there, it's almost like they just gave into that because they said that there is a need for it or there is a use for it. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, it does. It's a valid point, and I wanted to read here. Ed Oswald tweeted at us again. He said, "Look at PA Weather Action Mess. People shared it far and wide, and you know, some people knew it was wrong." That was concerning the severe weather that happened in the Mid-Atlantic. I guess it was last week or last weekend.
Right, Sunday.
Sunday, yeah. And they had this crazy thing. I don't even want to give it the attention, you know, because it doesn't deserve it. But, that was shared a lot, and people were expecting a lot of severe weather and, you know, long-lived track tornadoes. And I think that text was in there. And so, yeah, thanks, Ed, for that I guess we should move on here. We spent a lot of time on this topic, and we could probably could dedicate a whole episode to it, so maybe we'll do that in the future. But let's move on to our next tweet. Let's see. I'm going to... So it's Capital Weather Gang. It's another article by the Capital Weather Gang, and you can follow them at Capital Weather. The tweet is, Congress is considering privatizing key roles of the Weather Service. That's a mistake. Tyler, you shared this one, so I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, this is actually something I hadn't seen before a couple of hours ago. Apparently, an Oklahoma representative, his name is Jim Bridenstine, proposed some legislation that would prohibit the Weather Service from creating new services if the private industry already does it or could do it. This kind of showed up in a Twitter thread where there was some AccuWeather meteorologists talking about how they already issue tornado warnings for their private industry customers. And I can't remember the person. Some tweets have been deleted, I should say. But the person made the point that they do it very well. Obviously, we know that right now the National Weather Service is the official source of weather alerts in this country. I don't know the other details here of what this representative proposed. I mean, I am in an area where the Weather Service does a pretty poor job sometimes. We don't have a Weather Service office in Connecticut, but we have three. You know, Connecticut's small, right? We have three offices that cover the same small state, and oftentimes when you're on the border, there are huge problems that exist, warnings that don't continue into the next office area, a spotty map where you have no science background to reasoning to why certain alerts are in different places. So sometimes you can't even show the map because it doesn't make sense. You have holes where there are no alerts. You go north and south and there's an alert. So I can see ways that the Weather Service can improve, but I would never support some private company from doing... I've never support a private company issuing at least severe weather alerts.
If it was just that, if it was one place issuing the alerts, that'd be a different story. But you're gonna if you were to do that, you'd have all these different companies issuing, you know, warnings and tornado warnings, and then, you know, one place issues a warning, and it's not the other company doesn't. And I think that's a, you know, not a great spot to be in the weather enterprise, to have all those different warnings, and that it just create a lot of confusion, I think.
I would agree, and I'll add that I think that what AccuWeather does, they actually do very well. There are private companies that will pay AccuWeather to get advanced warnings on supercells or thunderstorms and whatnot. I know, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but in the rail industry, the railroad industry, they have a really big client, and they've saved them a lot of money because they've been able to divert their trains. And that's needed in the weather enterprise, but we need a centralized, I believe, source for general public warnings, and there's no way, in my opinion, you could really take that core mission of the National Weather Service away from them.
I guess the representative made the point that the Weather Service should focus on providing the core data sets to everything and then letting other people build off of those data sets. I absolutely don't think weather warnings is one area that needs to be done. You could argue that the Weather Service has gone too far into the social media and broadcasting side of things, though. You could argue that.
Absolutely, yes.
But not weather warnings. I mean, we just got through talking about the fragmentation of weather communication and how people don't know where they're getting their weather from. They don't understand the reputation of sources. And now if we break up the warnings and let everyone do it, that would make our problem 10 times bigger.
I'm curious. You said you could make the argument for National Weather Service going too far into the broadcast and social media side. What is the argument there? Should they not be on, like, social media and sharing things via social media?
Well, if you think back 10 years ago, there was no Twitter account for the National Weather Service, and they were not communicating directly to the forecast consumer in the way that they are nowadays. They probably had a website 10 years ago where you could request a forecast, but I would argue that most people didn't go there to get a forecast. Now, they still have that, but they're making graphics and
not here, but I've heard that in some places they do videos and they maybe do live videos, and they're absolutely edging into what we do and, you know, expanding their horizons with new technology. And in some ways you could view it as competition to what private companies do, television stations, radio, you know, especially if you follow the Weather Service on Twitter. Ryan, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I would be much more comfortable with a private company or the private sector of the weather enterprise saying, hey, Weather Service, lay off the social media bit. You know, we have that covered. I would be okay with that kind of a discussion taking place, because even though all of these new tools are out there and you have meteorologists and the Weather Service making fancy graphics for social media and whatnot, they have not upped their staffing. So if they wanted to do that, maybe they should make a commitment to that, and then again, maybe there would be more of a debate in the weather enterprise. But my question is, if you're just dividing up your staff's time even more and making people make graphics and tweet and Facebook and answer questions and all that stuff, are the regular tasks around the office being sacrificed for that social media bit, which gets your office's name out there more? You know, that is a question that could be asked. I'm not saying it needs to be, but it could be. And I think that kind of a discussion would be better than this whole weather warning nonsense, because yeah, they do a fantastic job at issuing warnings.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that, because a lot of times I see the graphics that they share on social media, and a lot of times they're not that great. And I'm assuming it's because they haven't, you know, put the amount of resources that they should have in creating those.
I think it
graphics.
Varies by office.
Yeah, you're
right. Has great graphics, and I think that Boston kind of took some of those graphics and uses them in winter weather too. So it certainly varies by office.
I do think though. I think they should be on social media. I think it's great. You know, the more they can get their message across, the more people they can get their message across to. I think that's good, and I think we have to remember that we're all in this together. In terms of issuing warnings and knowing people are aware of what's going on. Maybe I'm naive because, you know, it is all about money at the end of the day, but I think we have to realize that we're all in this together.
Well, I would add to what Ryan's point is, and that we each in our own categories need to do the best that we can do. As TV broadcasters, we are at the end of the game. We are communicating the forecast. And if it's not accurate, then everything falls down a little bit. And I can't tell you how many instances of storms there are in this part of the country, and I'm sure the whole country, where the warnings are not all that great. Sometimes even with a tornado debris signature in the Northeast, the warnings are missed. There's not even a tornado warning that's issued. So you absolutely could argue that there's a degradation in the quality of weather alerts, and therefore the entire chain suffers.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that, and I think that, like I said, if there's going to be a discussion about the roles of each sector of the weather enterprise, this is an area of discussion that should occur, not about the weather warning stuff. I think it's, what is your role? And it takes us back to the 2000s. We learned about this at Penn State with Ray Mann. The National Academy of Sciences commissioned a report that defines what each sector should focus on. And in some ways, especially through the outreach and the social media, the Weather Service has actually gone away from the recommendations made in documents like the Fair Weather Report. It's just a comment. I'm not saying it's wrong. But if we're going to evaluate our roles, that's a place where we can at least start. You know, focus on your strengths would be my comment.
Yeah, I agree there. And I wanted to share this one last thing. Devin chimed in on Twitter. He said, I have no problem with private sector issuing alerts to clients as added value, but government issuing public alerts is best. Basically what Ryan said earlier. So thanks, Devin, for chiming in there. So this was a great discussion, and we're probably going to dedicate an entire episode, although we're almost 30 minutes in here and haven't gotten to the main topic, but Let's do that. Let's go on to the main topic. And tonight we wanted to talk about a little bit of a less controversial issue, or not even an issue really, and that's establishing your network and how important that is in the weather community and in your education and then in your career. And so, Ryan, I think you're a perfect guest for this because you just came out of your degree and you're in the workforce now. So I wanted to start off with just getting a feel for what you do now, both at your job and on the side with Atkinson Weather, how all that is going.
Well, thanks again for having me. You know, this is a great topic, I think, and I hope that if any college students or high school students who might be interested in meteorology are listening, you know, they learn something from this, or maybe mentors listening, you know, learn something. You know, and I'm not a perfect example, but I think that coincidentally, through what I've done, I've built up a little bit of a brand, and a lot of that with the help of the mentors, you know, that I've had through my career. As far as what I'm doing now, I graduated from Penn State a month and 3 days ago. Can't believe it. And I've been interested in a job in the broadcast field for a long time. And normally what you hear from people who have gone into that field is that, you know, you have to apply everywhere, send your resumes everywhere, send your resume tape everywhere. And I was prepared to do that. And in fact, I had started doing that. And then I moved home a couple of weeks ago, and I had reached out to a meteorologist at NH1 News named Joe Joyce. And Joe and I have known each other for several years because I was a weather watcher for him as a high schooler and through college as well. I sent him my resume tape, and I sent him my resume, and he invited me up, and they're kind of squeezing me into their schedule. So I'm working part-time for NH1. You'll primarily see me on Fridays and weekends or when they need me. And it's a fantastic opportunity to begin my career in my home state where my family, my friends can watch. I never thought that would happen, so I'm incredibly lucky to have this opportunity. I'm very thankful. Of course, ultimately, I'm looking for something, you know, more regular because I enjoy meteorology. I would like to be doing it 5 days a week. But this is a great opportunity, and I'm really happy to be with NH1. And it's a really great station, a lot of nice people. It's brand new. So that's all well and good. As far as AtkinsonWeather.com goes, you mentioned that I started that in 2006. So now we're in our 10th year. Actually, wow. I was in middle school then. And it's come a long ways. And if you'll allow me just for a minute, I'll kind of explain the background, and I think you'll get a kick out of this because I don't even think the two of you know this story. But I was 9 years old, and growing up in New England, you're able to see everything. I haven't had a landfalling hurricane here in my lifetime, but those do happen here. But thunderstorms, snowstorms, heat, humidity, Arctic outbreaks, you get everything here. And I think that as a kid, I was always aware of the weather because I played sports. I was outside. But my interest in weather really exploded when I started skiing. And my dad would ask me to check out the websites of New Hampshire ski resorts and see where the conditions were best. And I was in third grade at that time. And I started to get really interested in snowstorms. I really wanted snowstorms, so I would naturally watch the local TV stations. And I was 9 years old, and I sent the chief meteorologist at the NBC station in Boston an email at the time. They had been looking for weather spotters. And without telling my parents, I'm 9 years old, I emailed the chief meteorologist at the NBC affiliate in Boston and said, "Hello, my name is Ryan Breton from Atkinson, New Hampshire. I would love to be your Atkinson weather spotter." Didn't tell my parents this until I got an email back from Todd Gross at the time that said, "Thank you so much for your interest, Ryan. Email me back when you're 10. So,
that is the 1 year.
Maybe he thought it was a passing interest and it wouldn't.
Oh, I see.
Wouldn't really, you know, materialize into anything. He didn't want to put the time in. I mean, this is 2005 at that point, I believe, 2004, 2005. So I was on like an AOL.com email. I mean, we're back in that era.
Some people still are.
A couple people, that's right.
My dad.
That's great. My mother is, actually. But anyway, I emailed him back on my 10th birthday, and I became a weather spotter for Atkinson. And he had a really fantastic network of weather spotters in the mid-2000s in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And there'd be weather spotter group chats on Yahoo Messenger, and people would talk about weather and all this stuff, and I was like, wow, this is great. You know, and I don't really think at the time I really fully appreciated that, but it was cool to me. And then I made a website where initially it was like my grandma and my aunt and my uncle that would look at what I was posting. But over time, I gained a lot of credibility in my local area because where I'm situated, I'm kind of in between Manchester, New Hampshire, and Boston, and our weather here can sometimes be different than the two of them. And especially through high school, I gained a lot of credibility on my Atkinson Weather website and through Facebook and whatnot, and have been fortunate enough to gain a bit of a following. And it actually gave me some real experience on not only how to forecast, but how to effectively communicate weather information to a fairly significant or large audience.
Well, that's a fascinating story. Congratulations on 10 years for the website. That's a big milestone. I'll never forget when you did some chroma key work with your MacBook, and I was sitting with my friend, and now your friend, Michael Page, and we were like, boy, this kid is good. That was before you came to Penn State. So a good accomplishment there. So we're talking about building a community, building connections here in the weather community, and obviously the website has allowed you to do that. Speak to how important the connections are, and maybe how you've done some things differently than your peers.
Well, I would say that I think that you hear about mentors and you hear about networking, and if you're doing it right, you probably don't realize you're doing it, if that makes some sense. For example, I don't walk into a room at an AMS conference and say, I'm going to network today. You know, that's never been my mindset, and that very well could be because of my personality. I'm an outgoing person as it is, and I'm comfortable with speaking with other people, and I enjoy that, and I get my energy from being with other people. So that could very much just be the way that I am. But I think that it's so important to, and I haven't done everything perfectly, and I don't want to make it seem like I've done everything perfectly, because I've learned from mistakes I've made and interactions I've had, just like anybody has. But I would say that I have different areas of contacts that I've made, and my local contacts actually led me to get an internship. So I mentioned I started as a weather spotter for one of the Boston stations when I was in elementary school, fifth grade. Then I became a weather spotter for all of the Boston stations. So through high school, I was regularly in contact with meteorologists at all of the different stations. And at the time, I don't really think I understood that was networking. It was just something that I did because I enjoyed it. I would send them observations and pictures and whatnot. And then, especially in my middle school years, a meteorologist at New England Cable News, Matt Noyce, was a very influential mentor to me. And kind of led me in a good direction in terms of forecasting and being responsible and whatnot. And he invited me down to the station. He came to my school and spoke. And Matt and I were quite close for a number of years. And he led me in a great direction, especially when talking about college. He went to Cornell. I was interested in Penn State, but also maybe a little bit interested in Cornell. So my contacts in high school allowed me to kind of go in a direction I wanted to go in for college. And he also gave me some really good advice in terms of the academic program in a meteorology program, because mathematics is not my strength, and it wasn't his strength. And knowing that he had struggled with math and I was struggling with math, even in college, I remember these conversations I had with him that, you know, just hang in there, we've all been there, you'll be fine. And try again, if you fall down, you know, get back up. So I think that was one really early on example of a mentor in building a network. Another one would be I landed an internship at WCVB in Boston after my junior year at Penn State, or I'm sorry, after my sophomore year and my junior year at Penn State. And I really got that through a connection I had made with Harvey Leonard, who was a fantastic mentor to many meteorologists. Whether they've encountered him or not, he's somebody that a lot of people look up to. He's an incredible meteorologist, an even better person. And I learned a lot from him, not only about how to forecast the weather, but how to treat other people and how to conduct yourself in the professional world and whatnot. So those are mentors on my side of the field that I met through my own. I also would say that one quick thing here, if you're going to a conference like the AMS or NWA and you're a student, there are so many opportunities to meet great people in our field there. People like Maureen McCann, Eric Pitlack, Cheryl Nelson are all people, and Bernadette Woods, all people that I've met at these conferences. And it may not necessarily be in the middle of the meeting. It may be after, at the happy hour or the cocktail hour, and you go up to them and you chat. And I'm quite close with all of those now, and I consider them all, you know, great role models and mentors to me. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I like that. And I want to go back to something you said earlier. You mentioned that when you're networking, the good people who are networking don't notice it. And I think you're absolutely right. And at first, my first AMS conference, I don't think that's what I thought. I thought it was like, oh my gosh, I'm in this room with all these important people and people that know more than me, and I want to meet them all. And I think at first I was like, you know, I do need to network these people. I need to talk with them and I don't know, show them that I am, I don't know, a good person and that I can talk to them and it's fun. But now it is so natural at conferences and other places where it is kind of just a groove, you get into a rhythm. So I wanted to see from your perspective at your first AMS, or unless you went to NWA first, at your first conference, do you remember kind of your experience and how you got into that groove of networking?
Well, I would say at the first AMS, I went to Atlanta in 2013, was my first big meeting. And it was intense the first day and overwhelming. And the first day I was kind of shy and didn't really approach too many people. But the second night, we were actually at one of the sponsored evening events at AMS. And this is a great story, and it actually kind of goes back to building your brand a little bit. As I mentioned, I had created that whole website, I had a Twitter account and whatnot, so I put myself out there, and just kind of naturally I gained a following. And I was in one of these receptions, and Maureen McCann was in the room, and I thought it was her, but I had never met her in person. And she came up to me and she said, "Ryan, that's you, isn't it?" And I said, "Maureen, that's you." We had already interacted a little bit on Twitter before. So that kind of broke the ice for me, I would say. That was really my first interaction with a professional at a conference and that kind of an atmosphere. And she was great, and she was so approachable, and we still keep in touch today. And she was just a really good example of what AMS should be like to students. And now she's actually on pretty high up in the AMS, on the board for AMS. And I think that you just have to have that one experience that shows you it's okay to go out of your comfort zone and interact with these people who you've never met before and may be quite successful in your field. And Maureen kind of showed me that, you know, that's why you're here. You know, take advantage. And I'm thankful for that, because I think that after that moment, you know, I realized it's completely okay to go up to these people, you know, during these you know, evening events and even during the conference too. And at the time, I think I was only like 19 years old. So fairly early on, I learned that, you know, networking isn't, okay, I'm going to network. It's, let's have a natural conversation, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
A number of people would say you've posted controversial tweets in the past, whether they be political or weather in nature. How do you make sure that you're not damaging your reputation?
That's a good question. I would say that when I was in college, and certainly the early part of college, you know, I would post sports tweets, political tweets, kind of, it was, I didn't really have a difference between a professional Twitter account and a personal Twitter account 3 or 4 years ago, you know, as an 18 or 19 year old. And I was more living in the moment, I guess. I would post my weather tweets, I would do whatever. If I found an interesting or controversial article, I would post it. You know, whether that be about climate change or politics, whatever the case may be. And I think that I learned, especially in the last 2 years, that, you know, I'm older now, really should not veer into that. So I think that if you look at the way that I present myself on social media today versus the way maybe 3 years ago I presented myself on social media as a immature, not immature, I mean I was fairly mature, but a 19-year-old not really considering the future, I would say that I'm certainly, you know, more in the professional realm now.
So, and I might be pulling back the curtain here, but a lot of broadcast media artists make a second account, one for their kind of professional Twitter and tweets, and then one for kind of a more personal thing. Do you guys do that?
I have one, and I maintained it a little bit more in college and in high school and whatnot. But I actually think that when I was younger and I had a following on Twitter of, you know, 1,000 or whatever the case may be, I put some of the personal stuff out there because, oh, I have this following. Maybe I'll get a retweet or a like or whatever the case may be. You know, that. So some advice I would say to high schoolers or college students would be to keep them separate.
What would be your recommendation to others in the weather community when it comes to treating disagreements on Twitter, things they don't disagree with, or just negative content in general?
Well, I actually was talking with Dakota about this a little bit yesterday. I've pretty much taken myself out of the Twitter debates that happen in the weather community. There are so many meteorologists on Twitter, for example, that if one article is posted, it seems like at least once a week there's some sort of mini-debate. And I've, for the most part, taken myself out of that just because it's kind of energy I don't want to spend on worrying about, you know, what's, honestly, it's just me. What's my opinion mean to somebody who posted an article about X, Y, or Z or something like that? So I can understand why people will go back and forth on Twitter, but I think that I've found myself getting less and less involved in the day-to-day weather community debates that happen. And actually, one example, I'll bring this up really quickly, where I think I can cross the line on occasion, is I care so much about the value of the forecast. So in the wintertime, when a broadcast meteorologist shares on the air a 6-day snowfall forecast from the European model at 100 kilometer resolution in their WSI system that frankly is a piece of crap, I've called them out before, because the odds of 12 inches of snow falling in Boston 6 days from now, I don't care if you give all the sort of disclaimers and whatnot, it's not going to happen. And if it does, you know, more power to you. But I think that I realize that I should no longer worry about what others are saying and just focus on doing the best job that I can do. And I think that one mistake I made was calling out a local meteorologist after, I think he worked, you know, a long shift and he was frustrated, and, you know, maybe there was a management involved that wanted them to show that on TV, but I was very much against it because I cared so much about the quality of the forecast and the quality, like I mentioned earlier, controlling the message. Why are we putting this out there if we don't know if it will happen? I think that I've stepped back from that, and I learned from that experience that I should just focus on myself and not what others are doing.
So I've kind of trended in the opposite direction of you. I used to be kind of a lurker, and I only commented every now and then, but now I find myself in these long Twitter threads, and you know, generally it's not a nasty back and forth. It's more of a very, because the people I'm interacting with are very rational and very calm about it. And the reason I've upped it, and it's not, I haven't, you know, consciously made this decision.
Well, you're lonely out there.
Yeah, nice one. the reason I've upped it, kind of in a natural sense, is it helps me figure out my standpoint. Because when I bounce things off of people and then hear their opinion, it adds to how I view something, and that's not necessarily important for other people to hear about and know, but it's helpful for me to kind of figure out where I stand and get a better kind of overall picture of what's going on. So I don't really do it for the disagreement. Sometimes I call people out every now and then, but I don't do that as much. More just a conversation, a helpful conversation.
Yeah, I don't feel the need either to get involved in these Twitter wars. There are other things to do in life, and a saying I really like is, it's better to be a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt that you're a fool, you know, as it regards any sort of topic. So that's the other thing about Twitter, and you kind of touched on that, Dakota. Once you put it out there, that's your opinion. I think some things are better suited for the bar, like after an AMS meeting.
Yeah.
And I would agree with that, too. I think that it's so tough if you're, you know, you're an opinion. I'm an opinionated person, and it's normally because I care about either the person or the outlet they represent or the area they're forecasting for that I would even get involved in something. I think that it's just some things are better left unsaid on Twitter, at least in a situation where you're going to be a broadcast meteorologist. I think that in some ways Dakota has the luxury because you're a researcher, you're in academia, you're not looking for a job on TV, so you can openly criticize the guy from Slate or, you know, a meteorologist at a TV station and not worry necessarily about not getting a job with them.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's something, you know, if you judge me off of arguments that I had, or not necessarily arguments, but debates and commentary that I've had, good discussions with meteorologists on Twitter, you might think, hey, that guy's a jerk, or he thinks he's all that. When in reality, I think if you know me, it's just that you know I'm passionate and that I care a lot about the field, and I care about the people in the field, and I care about what the user, the general public, sees. So for me, it's just better to remove myself from that because then I remove any chance of being misunderstood, I would say.
Yeah. One thing I don't know how I could do this, but I want to find an example, and they're probably few and far between, but I want to find an example of a conversation that happened on Twitter and a really good idea coming out of it, and then something actually happening because of that idea. I'm sure it's happened before because I've seen some, you know, researchers talk on Twitter, and whether it's about data or about coding, and sometimes there might be kind of a disagreement, but I think in the end of the day, sometimes there's a nice, I don't know, idea that comes out of it. So I'd be curious to see how often that happens.
One example I think that could be is those SPC maps that were drawn up by, is it Patrick Marsh, I think?
Yeah.
I think he only started those, you know, maybe just as a hobby. And then people saw them spread, and there was, some people were against them because, the private sector should make the pretty graphics. But I think they're great. And I think that could be one example where something positive came out of a Twitter debate, that those are now out there for everybody to use.
What are your opinions on deleting tweets?
I think that I delete tweets if I think that, you know, I feel like they should be deleted. Let's ask Hillary Clinton. She tweeted today that, about deleting.
Well, the junkies gets political.
she talked about a whole account.
What's that?
I said she talked about a whole account. I delete a few things, but really you have to do it with the understanding that it's not really going away. Someone could have taken a screenshot of it.
Oh, absolutely. Correct. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I do it rarely.
I hope not many people have screenshots of my tweets, good or bad. It's a little scary, but you make a valid point.
Yeah, I only do it when I think what I said was objectively wrong, and then I wasn't fair to someone or something like
that.
You
don't want to keep getting retweets.
Yeah, kind of like that, actually. I've never seen someone take a screenshot of something I deleted, so I'm waiting for that day. That'll be a milestone.
Yeah, same here.
Do you think that as broadcasters, we need to be completely objective in our not only tweets, but also liking or favoriting of social media content online?
As broadcast meteorologists, is that your question, or as broadcasters?
Yes, as broadcast meteorologists.
I think that it's probably smart to be as impartial as you can be, but I don't know that it's a necessary requirement in terms of news stories or whatever the case may be. You know, I've certainly found myself, you know, becoming much more impartial and not, you know, people don't need to know my opinion on something. Do they really care? Probably not.
So you can sneak in a like here and there.
Yeah, you know, you can give it a try, but...
I mean, you could certainly look across Twitter and see many news types doing all sorts of egregious things with the like functionality. So I think you're right in saying we should be sensitive to that, but it's there are other people that have bigger issues.
Right, absolutely.
So I want to bring this back to establishing a network and mentors and weather. Have you kind of had a significant mentor throughout your high school, maybe college, and now in your career that's helped you along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that I mentioned him before, Harvey Leonard at WCVB in Boston. And I've been fortunate that I've had many people give me advice and mentor me in different ways. But Harvey, especially the past 6 years, 5 or 6 years, I would say has been a consistent, you know, force and presence in whether it was my education or my internship or whatever the case may be. I actually visited him after my freshman year in college and went to tour the station and met him, and then I got involved with an internship there after my sophomore year, and then I was fortunate enough for him to bring me back a second summer, which doesn't happen all that often. And with him, he has a great quote about internships, and I think it's so true. It's a two-way street. I felt like I was teaching him close to as much as he was teaching me at times. You know, I learned so much from him, and I don't want to diminish that fact, but he made me feel like I was the most important person in the room every time I was in the room with him. And whether it was social media or graphics or new websites for weather information, during the 2 years I was with him, I learned a lot from him, and he tells me he learned a lot from me and that he learned a lot from all of his interns. And I think that's, if you're looking for an internship, you should find one that's a two-way street. And I sincerely hope that everybody has as great of an opportunity as I did. Of course, it was great to be in Boston and all that, but to have somebody who was in every sense of the word, a mentor, was great, and he's somebody that I can still text or call anytime, and we're in touch frequently, and, you know, in the whole job process, I could spend an hour on the phone with him and talk things over. So in every sense of the word, he's been my mentor.
That is absolutely some great advice. I've had a similar experience, as you know, here in Connecticut with Brad Field. So that brings me to my next question. What is your advice to those looking for an internship of this quality, the one we're talking about, the quality we're talking about?
You have to really put yourself out there and be consistent and give it your all. Act like you really want the job and you really want to, you want to be there not only to learn but to help. You have to want to offer something. And I think that both of us offer our graphics talent, certainly, and kind of served as weather producers in our particular internships, which was great, really contributing to the two-way street. It's not like you're working for them, you're working with them. And if you can make a commitment to work with whoever you're going to have your internship with, and you're not just working for them, I can guarantee you, you will get so much more out of that. And, you know, I commuted, you know, 50 minutes or more every day for the last two summers, and it was fun. It was not work to me because I got so much out of it, and I also felt like I was offering a lot, and they loved what I was offering. So my advice would be you really need to put yourself out there, be consistent, make connections early on. I can guarantee you that if I hadn't reached out to Harvey, you know, early in my academic career, that I probably wouldn't have landed two internships there. And I've actually given that advice to people at Penn State if they haven't heard back from somebody regarding an internship. I remind them that person's busy. They have a job to do. You know, send them another email or give them another call. For example, we weren't sure if at the corporate level I would be allowed to have a second internship there. We were lucky enough we were able to work it out. But I was actually on vacation in Florida last March, and I had to leave my friends and for an hour and a half be on the phone back and forth trying to make sure we could make this happen. You have to have a commitment, and you have to really want it. And if you really want it, you'll probably get a lot out of it.
Be consistent and put yourself out there, Ryan. I think that's great advice. And thanks so much for joining us tonight. Really, really fun episode. I think it might be the most fun I've had on an episode thus far. So thanks again for taking some time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me. If you ever are interested again, I'd be happy to come on. It's a lot of fun. And this, I have to give a shout-out, Dakota. This is like our old up-in-the-air days.
Oh, my gosh. I almost forgot. Yeah, you're right. This would be the second time we've appeared on a some sort of broadcast platform.
Right.
That's pretty cool. So if you don't follow us already, you can follow us on Twitter at the WX Junkies. And we live tweet the show, so if you want to comment, chime in, we normally read those tweets. If you have a question, we'd be glad to take them in future shows. We're also on Facebook. You can find this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, or iTunes. And please go ahead and give us a rating or a review. It'd be great to hear from you. And I want to take some time here. We had a comment, I guess last week, that we've had a lot of Penn Staters on the show, and that's absolutely true. I'm not going to deny that. And it's generally because that's the people that we're connected to. That's kind of our network. A lot of them are Penn State people, and we try to mix it up as much as we can in terms of field, in terms of where they're from and backgrounds, and we'll continue to do that in the future. But if it's a Penn State overload, we apologize for that. It's just the people that we're talking to, and you know, we don't have a lot of time to reach out to people, and friends are more likely to come on the show just because they know us anyways. So just wanted to comment on that, and I want to give one pitch to Whether Ready or Not. If you haven't listened to that podcast, I've had one episode. Go ahead and get it a listen. It's on all the Weather Junkies platforms. Tyler, you want to send us out?
Next week, we have Andrea Thompson on the show. She is a senior science writer for Climate Central, and we will be discussing what it's like to write about climate science and write for the organization being Climate Central. So that is our episode for next week. For this week, that is all for Ryan, Dakota, and I. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us right back here next week.
Cow. I gotta go, Julia. We got cows.